William and the Badminton Racket. William sat on the roof of the tool shed and watched as his sister Ethel and her latest admirer, Dr. Horace Ashted, set off for the badminton club, swinging their rackets gaily as they went.
Everyone's got one but me, he said bitterly. Everyone.
Without a badminton racket of his own, William felt that life was hardly worth living. A new badminton club had been started in the village, and the craze had spread. Even the outlaws had rigged up a net of sorts in the old barn. Shuttlecocks were easily obtained from the club, and Ginger, Douglas and Henry had managed to procure discarded rackets from their elders. Assuming his humblest manner, William had approached Ethel for the loan of hers.
"I never heard of such a thing," she said, "as if I'd let you even touch my racket."
Later, knowing that she was safely in Hadley shopping, he went to borrow it for a game with the outlaws, but he found the cupboard where she kept it locked, and the key presumably with her in Hadley. This lack of trust in him grieved and shocked him. He had to content himself with a minute, undignified, infantile toy racket that belonged to Henry's small sister. Ethel's racket had been given her by Jimmy Moore. Jimmy Moore's continuing admiration of Ethel was part of the normal Ethel landscape. Ethel often returned to him in the intervals between her more exciting affairs. But despite his gift of the magnificent new badminton racket, Jimmy was currently in a state of eclipse, thanks to Dr. Horace Ashted, Dr. Bell's new assistant. Dr. Horace Ashted was a pale, pompous youth with a squeaky voice, a slight lisp, and a distressing habit of missing shots at badminton. There was no doubt that in looks and general personableness he was miles behind Jimmy Moore. But his father was a Harley Street specialist, and Dr. Horace Ashted meant himself to be a Harley Street specialist one day. Dr. Horace Ashted was clever, of course. He seemed so stupid that he must really be very clever. And his mother gave dinner parties to important people with titles and went to first nights and to Ascot. It was all so very different from the life Ethel knew, and it thrilled her. William liked Jimmy Moore, and he didn't like Dr. Horace Ashted, but they were equally useless as sources of badminton rackets. And then, as if the indignity of Henry's sister's toy racket wasn't enough, something else disastrous happened. There took place one of those mysterious rearrangements of school staff, which seemed to happen at regular intervals, and as a result, in place of the placid, easy-going gentleman who generally taught William French, there appeared a fierce man with a belligerent moustache, a ferocious scowl, and an awe-compelling eye.
"I can hold out as long as you, my boy," said this Mr. Coggan grimly, "and before I finish with you, you'll be doing the work you're set, and doing it properly."
There came a day when Mr. Coggan said that the next time William forgot to do his French homework, he'd be sent to the headmaster. William decided to bow his head to fate and give his full attention to his French exercises the evening before they were due.
"People die without fresh air," he said pathetically. "We had a lesson on it once in history. They died in a place in India called Blackpool because they hadn't any fresh air, same as I shall, staying in every night doing French exercises without oxygen and such like. Well, I jolly well hope old Cogs will be sorry, that's all."
He really did intend to devote that evening to his French exercise, and he would have done so had not a new air gun been sent him unexpectedly by Aunt Louie, who had a pleasant habit of sending what she called unbirthday presents. He spent the evening hunting happily with it in the woods until after his bedtime, and only when he woke the next morning did the full horror of the situation dawn on him. His mind leapt nimbly to the only possible solution. He must be ill, really ill, seriously ill. His mind went quickly over the possibilities. Headaches were no good. He'd tried them often. Rheumatism was worse. He was simply laughed at when he tried rheumatism. There was lameness, of course. He did have rather a good limp, but it was a strain trying to keep it up all day. And infectious diseases needed symptoms that he'd tried in vain to reproduce before. Suddenly, he remembered Johnny Thorpe. Johnny Thorpe had been taken to a specialist in London who had diagnosed liver trouble. And he'd borne no awkward symptoms, such as rashes or swellings.
Liver trouble it was, decided William. Yes, but where was his liver? On the right? Just by his stomach, he thought vaguely. Anyway, he decided there must be something there, even if it wasn't his liver. He got out of bed and went to the top of the stairs. Mother, he called in a thin, quavering voice. He was rather proud of that voice. It expressed, he fondly hoped, unparalleled suffering heroically endured. My goodness, William, called Mrs. Brown from downstairs. Aren't you dressed yet? Mother, I'm not feeling well. Now, William, don't start that again. I don't want to, Mother, but I've got an awful pain. Mrs. Brown hesitated a moment, then came upstairs. William hastily got back into bed. Now, William, she said briskly, breakfast ready, and you'll only get into trouble if you're late for school. It's bacon and mushrooms. She watched him closely. William loved bacon and mushrooms. But by a supreme effort of will, he contorted his features into an expression of revulsion and made a low moan. Mrs. Brown began to feel a little worried. This was different from a limp that alternated between the left and right leg and vanished entirely every few minutes. Different, too, from a rash made with Ethel's lipstick and a swollen face whose swelling vanished when he was made to open his mouth. Where does it hurt, dear? Here, said William, vaguely indicating a point on the right of his stomach. Mrs. Brown pressed it tentatively, and William let out a yell that startled even himself. At that moment, there came from the garden the sound of Dr. Horace Ashted's squeaky voice, alternated with Ethel's more dulcet tones. He looked in before beginning his rounds to make arrangements for badminton that evening. Mrs. Brown went to the window. Would you mind coming up here a moment, Dr. Ashted? I'm afraid William's not well. Dr. Ashted, having fetched his bag from the car, entered William's bedroom, followed by Ethel.
Now, where did you say the pain was?
He squeaked importantly. He was delighted to have the opportunity to show off in front of Ethel. William pointed again to the spot whose choice seemed to be turning out to be so unexpectedly successful. Dr. Ashted pressed it so ungently that William's yell surpassed even his previous effort. He really does seem to be in pain, said Mrs. Brown. Dr. Ashted proceeded to make much play with his stethoscope as he tested William's heart. Ethel was quite as impressed as he meant her to be. The way Horace slipped those little things into his ears was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. The way he folded up that little telescope thing and put it back in his bag proclaimed heights undreamed of by Jimmy Moore.
You'll have to stay there for a little, I'm afraid,
he said at last, and went out, followed by Mrs. Brown and Ethel. William heaved a sigh of relief as the door closed. He could stay in bed this morning till the French lesson was safely over, and then stage a recovery as convincing as his illness. He wished he'd thought of liver before. Much easier than limps and rashes and that sort of thing. Outside on the landing, Dr. Ashted was saying, in his squeakiest and most important manner,
I'm afraid it's a case of acute appendicitis. We must get him removed to Hadley Nursing Home at once for an immediate operation.
Mrs. Brown and Ethel stared at him aghast. The idea that William, always the healthiest of all the Browns, should be thus stricken down was a terrible one.
Delay in such cases may be fatal. Dr. Bell is at the nursing home now. He'll operate at once.
Dr. Ashted was enjoying himself. The way that Ethel gazed at him in awe was intoxicating.
I'll telephone for the ambulance now, if I may, Mrs. Brown. On no account, of course, tell the boy himself. He must be kept very quiet.
There's no real danger, is there, Horace? Said Ethel.
There's always danger in an operation for appendicitis,
said Dr. Ashted portentously, thinking that Ethel would always see him as this cool, resourceful, capable master of diagnosis, an arbiter of destinies. While he and Mrs. Brown went down to the telephone, Ethel went briefly into her room and then entered William's bedroom. William looked at her warily. Suppose that, after all, the doctor had seen through the trick. But Ethel's face did not wear the expression of malicious glee that would have suited such an occasion. For Ethel was stricken by remorse. She wished she'd been kinder to William. She had decided to do what she could to make up for her past unkindnesses to him.
It's liver, isn't it? Said William, tentatively.
"I expect so, dear," said Ethel gently.
William gaped at her, struck speechless by her tone and the unusual mode of address. He'd just decided that she was being sarcastic when she brought out her badminton racket from behind her back.
"I want you to have this, William dear," she said sweetly.
For a moment, William thought he must really be ill after all and suffering from delirium. Perhaps it was all a dream. Perhaps he'd wake up in a few minutes and have to start having liver trouble all over again.
"Oh, thank you awfully. Thank you, Ethel," he stammered.
She laid the racket on the bed. He touched the handle.
"I'm feeling a bit better now."
She looked at him sadly, sighed, said, "Poor William," and went out. A few minutes later, Mrs. Brown entered the room.
"I say, Mother," said William anxiously, "I do feel ever so much better. I can push that place without it hurting now."
But Mrs. Brown wasn't listening to him. She was getting his dressing gown from behind the door. At first, when William was bundled into the waiting ambulance in his dressing gown, the wild idea occurred to him that they were playing a dastardly trick and taking him to school in this fashion. Then, as the ambulance sped past the school gates and into Hadley, his bewilderment gave way to panic. A few minutes later, William found himself in a hospital bed, with his old enemy, Dr. Bell, gazing down at him sardonically.
"Well, where's this pain?" he said.
His tone was conspicuously lacking in that tenderness and concern that William had begun to look upon as his right. Dr. Bell began to push and pummel him in the region of his stomach. He'd better let out his yell at once, or old Dr. Bell wouldn't believe in the pain. He let it out. But he let it out when Dr. Bell happened to be pressing the left side of his stomach.
"Oh," he said, "so that's where the pain is it?"
Yes, said William. "Yes, it's a jolly bad pain."
"I'm sure it is," said Dr. Bell, and pressed again.
William let out the yell again. Passers-by in the street heard it and turned pale. Dr. Bell went abruptly from the room. Mrs. Brown and Ethel were waiting anxiously outside.
"Are you going to operate at once?"
"No," said Dr. Bell grimly. "I'm not going to operate at all."
"Oh, dear," said Mrs. Brown faintly. "Is it as bad as that?"
"I'll tell you how bad it is," said Dr. Bell still more grimly.
He told her exactly how bad it was.
"Oh, dear," said Mrs. Brown. "Oh, dear."
Ethel said nothing. The glamour faded instantly from the figure of Dr. Horace Ashted. He couldn't play badminton, he couldn't sound his R's, he couldn't even diagnose appendicitis. He'd never end up in Harley Street, and even if he did, he'd be just as boring as he was now. William wandered morosely down the lane. His father had ruthlessly traced the affair to its source, and the result was one of the most painful interviews with the headmaster William had ever had. Even worse, Ethel had retrieved her badminton racket and locked it up once again. Moreover, Henry's little sister had discovered the loss of her toy racket and had demanded it back. William was now reduced to playing badminton with an old coal shovel. All things considered, he decided that life simply wasn't worth living. He was passing Jimmy Moore's house. Jimmy basked once more in Ethel's favour. Dr. Horace Ashted had applied for a post in London. He said there was no real scope for a man of his talent in a one-eyed little hole like this. Jimmy Moore knew he was indebted solely to William for his restoration to Ethel's favour. Ethel's favour, of course, was not of a very constant quality, but Jimmy nevertheless thanked fate and William. And now Jimmy was coming out of his house with a badminton racket in his hand. William's moroseness deepened. Everyone had one but him. Jimmy called after him.
"I say, I hear you're in want of a badminton racket. Would you like this?"
William gaped.
But it's a new one."
"Yes, yes. I happened to be in Hadley this morning and saw this."
He handed William the racket.
"I say... I say, thanks. Thanks awfully."
Jimmy winked at him.
"No, no. Thanks awfully. To you."
William set off down the road at a run. He whistled joyfully. He leapt into the air. He swung his badminton racket exultantly. Despite all its complications, life was, he decided, supremely well worth living. After all,